Welcome to North Pod Law, Series 3, Episode 6, recorded on the 8th of February, 2012. Drawing the Line.
It's the end of the series.
Hello, Ben.
Hello. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Last one of the series.
I know.
See you in 6 weeks. Can I go now?
Yes, off you pop.
Not too worried about us doing a show then.
I was just looking then to see if I had a door closing sound effect. I don't, turns out. Right, well, here we are at the end of the series. Coming up on this week's show, we have an interview with drugs trafficking expert solicitor Alared Darlington about the problems caused by the fixing of an arbitrary date for the coming into force of the new sentencing guidelines on drugs, which we've covered a lot so far on the show, but it turns out the problems that we thought might be happening, yeah, they may be already with us.
All very exciting. He's got cases pending in the Court of Appeal.
He does indeed, so more on that later. Why MPs calling for new law are behind the times. The latest and perhaps most surprising ruling from the Court of Protection. Your tweets. It's your tweets. How this week's Legal Services Consumer Panel report on comparison websites raises the question, why are lawyers not being wiser about their advertising investments? And whether lap dancing clubs are facing a swan thong. Do you see what I've done? Do you see?
No.
Good. But first, the government has refused it was largely by public pressure. What are they called now?
Petition?
Those things, that's the word. Struggling for the word petition. Petitions for Alan Turing to be granted an official pardon for convictions relating to homosexual activity in the 1950s. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm fairly sure I've posted things about this some time ago, but if not, you're probably already aware of it. 23,000 or thereabouts signatures sent to Justice Minister Lord McNally for consideration as to whether Mr. Turing perhaps ought to receive a pardon. It's not the first time it's come up. Gordon Brown, when he was PM in 2009, made an official apology to Alan Turing, describing the treatment that he had, according to the BBC's recollection of it, as utterly unfair and appalling. Now, if you don't know who he was, well, go and do a bit of Wikipediaing, but it's something of a local hero in Manchester, but also something of a wartime hero. It was his work at Bletchley Park that cracked the Germans' Enigma codes during the war.
I don't think he's just a local hero. He is very much a hero.
Also, he was, you know, one of the forefathers of modern computing, in the sense that we currently understand it. Now, he... there's sort of two different views, I suppose, of his convictions. So initially there's this incident, January 1952. This is where he meets a fellow called Arnold Murray outside a cinema in Manchester. They have some sort of lunch date. Turing invites Murray to spend the weekend with him at his house, an invitation which Murray accepts, although he then doesn't turn up. They meet again in Manchester the following Monday, when Murray agreed to accompany Turing to his house. A few weeks later, Murray did visit the house again and apparently spent the night there. What ultimately happened was that Murray helped another person break into Turing's house. Turing reported the crime to the police. During the investigation, Turing acknowledged, because he had to explain how it was that he knew Murray, that he'd had a sexual relationship with him. Now, of course, homosexual acts were illegal in the UK at the time, and so both of them charged, no burglary in there, charged with gross indecency. No, resist the joke, Bezic, I could see it coming. Charged with gross indecency under Section 11 of the Criminal Law Amendment Act 1885. The particularly sort of outrageous part of it by modern standards, other than that, was the fact that he was given a choice. He could either go to prison, jolly nice too. Or he could have a non-custodial sentence, as we would call it these days. But if he was to do that, he had to have a hormonal treatment designed to reduce his libido. In other words, it was an estrogen hormone injection that amounts to what we would these days describe as chemical castration.
Stop him being gay.
Yeah, absolutely, because of course it can be cured, you know.
With estrogen pills.
Apparently so, yeah. Or you know, brisk walks in the morning, I think, apparently do it as well. Just not on certain heaths. Apparently that doesn't help. Anyway, so that's kind of the long and short of it. A lot of people find that his contribution to, well, actually to our nation and also to the world was such that by modern understandings of whether that was an appropriate way of dealing with anyone, that was absolutely abhorrent, and as such, his posthumous pardon should be granted. The response to this, Lord McNally's response, was he says it is tragic that Alan Turing was convicted of an offence which now seems both cruel and absurd, particularly given his outstanding contribution to the war effort. However, the law at the time required a prosecution, and as such, long-standing policy has been to accept that such convictions took place, and rather than trying to alter the historical context to put right what cannot be put right, instead we should ensure that we never again return to those times. Of course, the story ended for Turing by him committing suicide in 1954, which was only 2 years after he was convicted. The reason it's so relevant at the moment is it's, 100 years since his birth. Yeah, so it's his 100th birthday this year. The answer, I suppose, to this is probably that although Lord McNally's analysis of that is quite right, that is the general principle, it is not, and it certainly wouldn't be, the only case where a posthumous pardon had been granted, where somebody was rightly convicted. In fact, ever since the powers passed from Her Majesty the Queen, or in fact I think it might even have been, was it the Queen at the time? Yeah, it would have been Elizabeth II, to the Secretary of State to grant these pardons, ever since then it has been quite thoroughly established that they should not be used in cases of wrongful conviction, because that is what the Court of Appeal is for. Even out of time. In fact, the setting up of the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which of course looks at, I suppose you might call them cold case appeals, exists for that purpose. And in fact, the pardon prerogative, such as it was, really was there to deal with cases where there was an injustice done by the state to somebody that was not a wrongful conviction at the time. So in actual fact, Turing's case really does fit it on all fours with the requirements as they are currently set out. So McNally seems to be setting a different rule.
They have used pardons in cases where people have been wrongly convicted, though. I'm thinking...
Let him have it, Chris.
Well, indeed. But yeah. The other one I'm thinking of was a case, actually, I think also in Manchester, where somebody challenged a parking fine, in effect, for parking on double yellow lines. He went out and measured them to find they didn't fit the required standard. And rather than risk several thousand people clogging up the Court of Appeal, they gave blanket pardons for it. But in fact, that would, of course, be wrongful convictions, in effect.
Yeah. Talk about an abuse of a prerogative.
Indeed.
For the convenience of the floodgate effect. Yeah, absolutely. If you find that abhorrent, and I have to say, at least 23,000 people do, then that petition, which is still knocking around online, if it reaches 100,000 signatures, of course, it then opens the possibility that it will have to be debated formally in the House of Commons. I would urge anyone, and here, in the interest of full declaration, my political agenda here is, please go and do that, because this is, you may think, absolutely bloody disgusting.
Well, it is, but I think the difficulty with it is that you have... Why him, specifically? It's not just him, is it? Either... Realistically, we should be pardoning everybody who was convicted of homosexuality, in which case I do understand the Mr. McNally's point of view that actually you can't... Is it Mr.?
Do you mean Lord McNally?
Is it Lord McNally? Yes. I think it probably is.
Lord McNally to you,
he's still Mr. McNally.
Yeah. No, that's his father.
It does... in effect, rewrite history, and that's not what it's about.
But doesn't it actually mark the mistakes of history. I mean, this argument that we can't rewrite it? Well, we do it in lots of other spheres of life.
Well,
we publicly mark things
we
publicly mark things that went wrong in the past by celebrating that we have now set them right. I mean, there's all sorts of examples of that, but.
But we have set it right. We've set it right by legalising homosexuality. We have done that. We have set it right in terms of what we recognise that it was wrong to convict people of these things, and we've done that by changing the law.
Well, should we not go further and say that subjecting someone to what we'd probably these days class as inhumane and degrading treatment by way of the way they dealt with him, and ultimately driving a man who had that degree of contribution to suicide... do we not think we ought to perhaps go a little further than simply saying, well, we changed the law, so it's all right
now? I think that is a different point.
Mm.
I think specifically in his case, there is possibly room for a pardon on the grounds of the manner in which he was treated. I'd also like to know what happened in his police interview in terms of how that confession came about. But in terms of actually merely pardoning him for it being a homosexual act, I think it almost takes something away from it, because you're not talking, you know, once that's done, well, he's been pardoned now, we don't need to talk about it anymore, do we? And I find that actually quite abhorrent, that these things can be, really, can we put it right by merely saying, yes, well, we pardon you now. Now you've committed suicide, we pardon you? Actually, doesn't it do him more justice to have him go down in history as somebody who was this badly treated?
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument against it as well that's been raised, although I have to say I think it's been largely discredited, which is that Sir Stuart Menzies, the spymaster to Winston Churchill, as he's described by Anthony Cave Brown in his book C, he raised the suggestion, well, he says it early in 1944, a suspicion arose that... Alan Turing might have been the man responsible for molesting schoolboys at the main public library in Luton, which I love the way he describes as a large industrial town not far from Bletchley. I can find Luton on a map, not sure I know where Bletchley is. While no proceedings arose, it was decided that he needed to be dismissed from his role there. Now, the interesting thing is, I think, first of all, I think that was utterly discredited, ultimately. I think there was... a degree of, homophobic nonsense being spoken about. Well, here we have a celebrated homosexual who Menzies described as a practicing and aggressive homosexual.
Well, yes. We know these homosexuals, they all have to mess around with little boys. We're all aware of that, surely.
Have you been reading the Daily Mail? Yeah. Have you noticed that whenever the Daily Mail talk about homosexuals, unless they're the sort of the nice sort or on television entertaining people...
Do the Mail have those?
Yeah, no, they don't mind some of them, apparently.
Adam Macy in The Archers is all right.
Yeah, well, that's that line from The Simpsons, isn't it? Where he hasn't realised that the new family friend is, as Marge puts it, prefers the company of men. Homer's response, well, who doesn't? when she eventually tells him that, you know, I actually think he might be a ho, yes, a ho-mo, sexual. And he says, you know me, Marge, I like my beer cold, my TV loud, and my homosexuals flaming. unfortunately, I think the Daily Mail subscribed to the Homer Simpson view of homosexuality. Anyway, if you agree with the powers that be, then so be it, and you can perhaps, if you feel so inclined, you can email us and tell us why. If you don't, on the other hand, then seek out that petition and perhaps add your voice to it. Okay, so now we move on to the question of drugs guidelines. Now, those, of course, who have listened to our show over the course of the last series will know that we've talked an awful lot about the sentencing guidelines and obviously recently in relation to drug offences. Now, of course, these offence guidelines come into force on the 27th of February. There are those who have recognised that because some sentences under those guidelines go down compared to the old regime, as well as those that go up, ultimately there is a two-tier regime operating here. We're joined, and I'm very grateful, on the line by Alured Darlington, a solicitor at Hamwell Chambers, in London. Good evening.
Good evening.
Now, there is a difficulty here, isn't there? The old guidelines, sentenced under the case of Aramar and the various others that altered it, they dealt with some offenders, drug offenders, rather more seriously than the new guidelines.
A lot more seriously. We're looking rarely with drug mules at something like a third of a third difference in years.
Now, of course, the people who fall to be sentenced after the 27th may well have committed their offences some considerable time ago.
Yes.
So when they committed the offences, they would have been, well, it may be a bit of a stretch to say they'd have been aware of what the law did in terms of sentencing, but they were committing offences under a different regime than the one they're now due to be sentenced under after the 27th. But there's an awkward transitional block in the middle. How exactly are those people going to be affected then?
Okay, now we're talking about the people who have already been sentenced, yes?
Right.
Do I have that correct?
Yes, so if somebody has already been sentenced under the old rules, they've fallen just shy of the 27th of February and now feel aggrieved because, of course, after the 27th of February, they'd have got a lot less.
I think they may have good reason to be aggrieved and indeed upset because they will be seeing people coming in under the new system who, under the new sentences on the 27th September, who may, in fact, have committed more serious offences than them, getting lesser sentences, and they will be in the same prison. And clearly, we will have this two-tier problem for some time. It's particularly relevant, or particularly stark, with regard to those cases of people who have only recently been sentenced. Now, the situation is that I have lodged six cases in the Court of Appeal. I won't discuss them in detail, but simply to say that my lead case is someone who was sentenced and received a sentence of 5 years on the 17th, the 19th of January 2012. Had the case been put back 5 weeks until the 27th of February, then she would have received, on my reckoning, probably about 3.5, but certainly not more than 4. I have another case on the 5th of January. Someone was dealt with on that particular day. They received a sentence of 7 years. Again, had their case been put off for 7 weeks, till the 27th of February, they would have been looking at a sentence of under 5 years. So it's a very unfortunate situation, and the only way that I can see it could be sorted out is by there being these appeals and persuading the Court of Appeal that these guidelines should be treated retrospectively.
How do you envisage...
Sorry, you're faint again.
Sorry, how do you envisage the Court of Appeal possibly solving that? Does it not involve them perhaps having to draw another arbitrary line, but earlier?
Well, that, in a way, would be very unjust, just to draw a line in the sand, because people will still feel upset because they just get on the wrong side of the arbitrary line. The only way to do it, really, is to allow all the appeals of anyone who's been sentenced and is still in prison under the old Aramar guidelines. The line I would draw is, have they been released or not? If they're still in prison, then we should have a situation where they should be sought out, these people. They should be told of their rights, and they should appeal. And I think that solicitors and barristers as well have a very real duty to look back. And I would say, it may seem a lot, but up to 10 years. And the reason I say 10 years is because there are people I know who, under the Aramar guidelines, got 20 years. So they could still be in prison now and could be affected by this.
Now,
all these cases should be looked at as to whether or not they are possibly appealable if, in fact, the guidelines were retrospective. May I make one point again with regard to where you draw the line?
Yes.
And this is a very important point. And probably the main reason I'm actually on this programme, because I want to get it home, is this, that the line the Court of Appeal may decide to use is to say anyone who appeals in time, we will in fact allow those appeals, and we'll draw the line there. Now, frankly, I think that would be enormously unfair, but it's possible it could happen. And because it would happen, it's very important indeed that anyone who has actually been sentenced within the last 28 days should get their appeal in right away. My most two recent cases that I referred to have both, we took great pains to ensure that those appeals were in within the 28 days. So they're all right on that basis. As I say, I don't think it would be fair to draw the line there, but we've got to be realistic and accept that it's possible it may happen. And because of that, appeals in those cases should be lodged right away. And that's incredibly important.
Well, there's some good advice there for any solicitors and counsel listening. Just looking at the rationale a little bit for this, the sentencing counsel, as we've discussed on the show before, we're obviously looking at the existing guidelines, and we've talked about the case of Aramar, when they were drawing these up, and they reached a decision that, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, that the sentences under Aramar were too harsh, and that is the reason why these guidelines have come down lower. Is that really the rationale?
If you look at the consultation papers, both with regard to the Sentencing Advisory Panel and also the Sentencing Advisory Council, they both refer to this, and they both say that the reason why it was done was because it was recognised that these sentences were out of kilter with sentences for other serious matters. And in common fairness, they should be brought down. Now, the other point with regard to that is that, and it's a very important point, is that it's not as if the sentences had suddenly become too harsh on the 27th of February. Obviously, because of the long time that this issue has been there, these sentences have in fact been too high for a considerable period of time, several years. And that is why it would be perfectly fair and reasonable to allow the appeals to go back in time.
Now, you talk about going back in time. The question of retroactive or retrospective, and this isn't legislation, but this is law, is there precedent for this?
Well, the point about non-retroactive activity, which is, of course, a reason that is sometimes quoted and may be used against my particular argument, is this. It's the basis on which that particular rule was actually founded. And the reason was because it was realized that if someone committed a crime and the sentence increased after they had committed that crime, then it would be unfair to them to punish them on the basis of a sentence which they didn't know about at the time they committed the offence.
But here we're in a very unusual opposite situation where the sentence would be more
exactly
lenient.
We're in the opposite situation entirely, in that the sentences are being decreased. And what is interesting, and is something that is in my grounds of appeal, is that there is a European case which is referred to in Archbold where this was broadly looked at. And it's an Italian case in the European Court, and the court in that case decided that it would not be fair.
That's the case of Scopola and Italy.
That's the case of Scopola, yeah.
So, I mean, essentially, where there have been exceptions to the principle of non-retroactivity, they've either been, and I suppose law students would talk to us about the Race Relations Act and so on, or basically where there have been exceptions caused by there being a perception of extreme injustice by the change. I suppose that's really the central thrust here, is that it becomes very arbitrary and unjust to not have that in their favour.
And that is why I think one can probably say in these cases that in view of the situation that has arisen, these sentences now would be manifestly wrong in principle. They would be just unjust, and there's no other way of looking at it, quite frankly. And could I just, since I've had the opportunity to say this, make another very important point. There'll be an awful lot of drug mules in prison sentenced years ago who've lost contact with their solicitors, and the solicitors have lost contact with them, who will not be aware of this situation. The only fair way to deal with them is for the government to look back at all these cases, if in fact the principle is accepted, make sure that they are brought out, and those people also have the opportunity to benefit from this appeal.
Well, we'll have to see if that's the approach the government takes. I have to say it would be surprising, perhaps in the light of some of their recent views on sentencing. But just one final point. I mean, we're talking here about drug mules, and as the papers have rightly identified, that's the area of offenders where there's been the biggest notable drop in sentencing guidelines.
Yes.
There are, of course, and again, we've covered it in the past on the show, there are other areas, other types of offenders within those guidelines where there are still some significant drops in sentence compared to the old regime.
Yeah.
I suppose the same thing by analogy may well apply in those cases.
Well, I think you can draw a distinction with regard to drug mules. The point is that with drug mules, there's no real chance of being able to fudge the interview, what actually happened. It's very clear what the sentence should be with regard to drug mules, and also the problem with regard to drug mules has been in the public domain for a very long time, and people have recognised, and as I say, the Sentencing Council and panel have recognised that these sentences were too long. So I think you can draw the line as saying that this should actually apply to drug mules only. I mean, if people want to extend it, that's up to them, and I wish them the best of luck.
I think that is the point, though, with the drug mules, isn't it, that the Sentencing Guidelines Council specifically recognised that they were lowering the sentences for that whole category of offenders. It wasn't sort of specific areas of offenders. It was a whole category, as in importation via drug mules. Does that sound right?
Well, I mean, certainly there's no doubt that there were vast changes over the whole area. It's a question to what extent it's realistic to deal with other offenders than drug mules. With drug mules, we are looking at people who have been sentenced to several years. And it's very clear and easy to see that something is very wrong with the difference between the old regime and the new regime. Yeah, it's probably not quite so clear with other offenders, which is why I say leave that battle for another day.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your insight on that, and it may be that at some point when the Court of Appeal have considered this, you might come back on the show and talk to us about it again. In the meantime, if people listening to this want to contact you or your firm, I think you're at Hamwell Chambers, which is in...
They're very welcome to.
It's Hamwell, London, isn't it?
Yeah, you'll find me on I've got a website, actually, at Hamwell Chambers, www. Never remember exactly what we call it.
We'll put a link online, don't worry.
Sorry?
We'll put a link on the show, don't worry. We've got your website.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, well, you can find me there. And also, there has been an article in the Solicitors Journal online yesterday about this whole subject.
Yes, indeed. Right, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we'll talk to you again at some point down the line once the Court of Appeals had a chance to mull this one over.
Thank you very much.
Interesting stuff, Kirsten.
Watch this space as to whether that is a successful challenge to sentences.
Now, MPs are behind the times, you know, in calling for a new law.
Bless them. A new law.
Mm. Yeah, now this is a consultation that opened, oh, crikey, God knows when. This is an inquiry consultation thingy from the Justice Unions Parliamentary Group, which is a cross-party job.
And it does appear that they are all up in arms about this.
Well, it does. Right, so this is a call, and you've probably seen this in the press this week. This is a call by MPs and peers for a law against stalking. What is stalking, the lawyers amongst you will ask, because actually it's a fairly good question. Let's have a little bit of history here. Back in 1996, there was a 10-minute rule bill forwarded, or rather put forward, called, guess what, the Stalking Bill 1996. That failed. It was put forward by Janet Anderson at the time, support from 64 MPs. Failed to get government support because the proposed offence failed to distinguish between reasonable and unreasonable conduct. Now, that wasn't insurmountable, it ultimately turned out, because, of course, you do know that in 1997 there came about the Protection from Harassment Act 1997, came to force on June the 16th of that year, and shortly after, which we'll return to this, in Scots law...
Well, in Scots, what they're actually asking for is, what they're saying is, the Harassment Act isn't good enough. People don't take stalking seriously. There is no law, apparently, in the rest of the United Kingdom, ignoring Scotland, that covers stalking. They've only got harassment. So, and to sort of add the cherry on the cake, in Scotland, on the 13th of December 2010, Section 39 of the Criminal Justice and Licensing Scotland Act 2010 came into
That's
force.
That's all that great bits of legislation that covers everything.
Yeah, this and Section 39 is specifically the offence of stalking. What the MPs are saying is that since that came into force, 400 people have been prosecuted in Scotland. It clearly marks out how seriously that law takes stalking, as opposed to the English law. So, Ben, do you want to read out the offence of stalking in the Scots law?
Yeah.
So this is apparently what we need in England and Wales.
All right, so it is. In fact, I tell you what, we're reading from a secondary instrument here. I think I actually have the proper one, the Act itself. It says that it is a course of conduct undertaken by person A... Can you hear us scratching around trying to find the right piece of paper? Thank you very much, Kirsten. All right, so here we go, yeah. A person, A, commits an offence to be known as the offence of stalking, where A stalks another person, B. For the purposes of that, A stalks B, where, unhelpfully, A engages in a course of conduct where either subsection 3 or 4 apply, we'll come back to them, and A's course of conduct causes B to suffer fear or alarm. All right, so course of conduct, what do 3 and 4 say? 3 is where A engages in a course of conduct with the intention of causing B to suffer fear or alarm, so that's intent. And 4, where A knows or ought to know in all the circumstances that engaging in the course of conduct would be likely to cause B to suffer fear or alarm. So that's recklessness, effectively. So you can commit it either way. And, of course, ultimately, they have to be caused fear or alarm. Now, that sounds a little bit...
Defences?
Oh, yes. Well, now that you see, there are some, yes. Let's just come to him. I'll see if we can find him, first of all. Crikey, where is it? Oh, yes, here we go. Subsection 5. It's a defence for a person charged with an offence under what you've just said, where they were authorised by virtue of any enactment or rule of law. So that's if the course of conduct, sorry, was authorised by virtue or, so in other words, if the law allowed for it specifically, or where the course of conduct was engaged in for the purpose of preventing or detecting crime.
It's pretty standard.
Or where the course of conduct was, in the particular circumstances, reasonable. So that's the point that caused the end of the 96 bill in England and Wales. Now, that may sound terribly familiar, because fear, alarm... there's two things missing for the usual construction in these things in English, which is... which one did I fear? Harassment, alarm, or distress. There we go. Now, the thing is, in Scottish law, the penalty, Kirsten, for that offence, so this is the penalty for somebody on indictment, so let's say the most serious cases.
On indictment, 5 years.
Now, 5 years imprisonment is the maximum sentence for causing, intentionally or recklessly, fear or alarm in Scottish law.
Although the actual statute is, of course, silent as to when these matters should be dealt with summarily and when they should be dealt with on indictment. You may think, listeners, that there would be a clear distinction between the intentional and the reckless, but who knows?
Or, if that's not where the distinction lies, Kirsten, may I suggest another?
Ooh, go on then.
Well, what about if that fear or alarm was specifically a fear or alarm about violence?
Really?
Now,
where do you get that idea from, Ben?
Do you see where I'm going with this? All right, so, yeah, silliness aside, the Protection from Harassment Act 1997 creates two offences that are relevant for our purposes here. One is an offence of causing a fear of violence. That one is punishable on indictment with a sentence of up to five years imprisonment. There is a lesser offence, which is the one of simply causing... I forget the blooming words now for the lesser offence.
Alarm and distress,
that's right, I think. For the lesser offence, that is summary only, so you'll know only up to 6 months imprisonment. Now... what MPs seem to be calling for is not a new offence of stalking, because the offence of stalking, if they're basing it, as Yvette Cooper has suggested when she responded to this, upon the Scottish law, well, we already have a law that says what the Scottish law says.
It's called the Protection from Harassment Act 1997.
What is different is that there is a distinction between the two separate offences in English law, which there isn't in Scottish law. And in order to get above the summary offences and into the territory of indictable offences, the more serious ones dealt with by a Crown Court, there has to be evidence of that person B was in fear of violence being used against them. Now, I would be curious to know, out of the 400, I think you said, convictions in Scotland...
how many of them are actually for basic harassment when relationship's broken up?
Yeah, how much, I think, as the parliamentary group, or certainly discussing in the Commons, were saying is, you know, equivalent of arguing over the hedge. And how many are actually fear of violence cases?
Well, I think the point on that is apparently there are 400 people who've been prosecuted since the Act came in December 2010.
Yeah.
And I find it really hard to believe that there are that number of Scots out there seriously stalking people. 400 within that period of time? Is it a particular Scottish fetish?
Well, it's course of conduct, isn't it? So it may, I don't know how.
It's not serious, is it? It's going to be 400 people involved in a course of conduct that has put person A under fear or alarm.
So the comparative figure for England and Wales would have to be inclusive of people who were prosecuted under the 1997 Act for all offences under both the lesser offence and the more serious. Yes. I'm going to hazard a guess that's more than 400 over that period of time.
I would think so.
Because you go to any magistrate's court on any given week and you're going to see at least five or six, I would have thought, in a week. And that's just in one court. I have to say I'm largely making these figures up because I've never conducted an inquiry, but I would imagine so.
I find it hard to understand as well in the English and Welsh law when we're talking about putting in fear of violence. It doesn't have to be immediate violence. So realistically, in a stalking case, this fear and alarm that is referred to in the Scots Act has got to be... It must mean fear or alarm of violence for the top end of the scale, because that is what you are worried about in a stalking case. You're not worried that, I'm alarmed that he keeps attending at my address and it's a bit of a nuisance. You're in fear that he's going to do something, or she.
Well, BBC, in their coverage of this, have got an example, and we can perhaps experiment with it then. So this is a woman called Tracy Morgan, who she's been a lobbyist in Westminster to create this new law against stalking. She says the following. Let's get out what she says, and then we'll cover it. So she says she was stalked for 10 years by a man she'd met at work. She said, "It's like being mentally raped. I was watched, followed, our home was broken into. We even had listening devices put in our bed. She says, serious stalking cases are actually being put in the same category as an argument over a hedge. That's where that comes from. What we want is a legal term of stalking so that stalking cases can be dealt with how they should be. It's a serious offence. It's not a benign nuisance crime. We are dealing with perpetrators who may go on to kill. Let's just deconstruct that a little.
Well, there's your fear of violence.
Yeah, now I appreciate she will be summarising massively in that one sentence there what's happened. So she says, 10 years, well, got course of conduct in there. It's like being mentally raped. Well, it doesn't really help us in terms of categorising.
Well, it's putting
it,
in harassment, alarm, distress, all those things,
so
isn't
that,
it?
So
you've got
already,
harassment already.
We're already making out the lower offence here. So, yeah, maximum here is 6 months thus far. Let's see where it goes. I was watched, followed. Our home was broken into. Well, watched and followed, still lower category. Our home was broken
well, not
into.
I don't think it is. If you're being watched and followed for a period of over a period of 10 years,
are you in fear
you
of
are
violence?
In fear of violence. I would suspect.
Maybe.
I would think it, either you're not. It's just a bit of a pain. Mm-hmm. In which case, you're in harassment, or you're being stalked. And that's the point: is that if you're being stalked,
yes,
it's something more than just somebody being a bit of a nuisance. It's a serious crime.
And that's the thing. What she's describing is something that is. It's either, if she says, well, I wasn't frightened by it, but all of this was happening and it was unpleasant, well, then there's a lower offence to deal with it.
Yeah.
Albeit over a long period of time, although I suspect he could be convicted multiple times for it.
We'll come back to that in terms of
and we know what, well, yes,
potential
absolutely.
Sentences after that.
And potential civil orders after that. Our home was broken into. Well, if there was enough evidence to charge a burglary, I'm sure that would have happened. I don't know if it was or not. We had listening devices put in our bed. Again, that's a bit of a tricky one, but probably comes under the lesser offence category, I think. Listening devices doesn't put you in fear of violence. It maybe.
Really?
Mm,
I mean,
could do.
What do we describe as violence? I mean, is somebody you frightened that somebody is going to get hold of you, kidnap you, do anything to you? Mm. It's that the thing about it is it's the fear of the unknown, and it is fear
well, that's right.
of I think it is fear of violence.
Well, so what she says is we want a new category, a legal term of stalking. Well, if you're talking, Ms. Morgan, about cases where somebody does all of these things and they make you frightened for your safety, a fear of violence, then that is already matching the Scottish law. The fact we don't call it stalking is academic. We're dealing with perpetrators who may go on to kill. Well, as you say, Kirsten, that's a good sign that we're talking about fear of violence. And if you, the victim of this, are able to genuinely say, yes, I'm in fear of violence, doesn't matter what the defendant no. says about it, the person's guilty of the offence, either with intent or recklessly. Mm. So there's another witness there who says, Sam Taylor, I mean, this is quite a bizarre one, believes the criminal justice system helped the man who stalked her to carry out his campaign of intimidation. She says, this man, he didn't know how to use computers until he went to prison. Now he's gone on to stalk close friends of mine. Now, if we're talking about cyber stalking, I suppose, then, again, if he's stalking you over a computer, and there is no fear of violence, and it doesn't actually say it has to be immediate or proximate violence within the act.
No.
It's simply if there are violent threats within it.
Well, it doesn't even have to be that. If you are so put in fear that, you know, well, I don't know, does he know where I live? Is he coming in the house? What is he going to do? You're there. You're on fear of violence. That's what stalking is.
Well, absolutely. I'm afraid, and the title of this this show is that we're drawing the line. You've got to wonder where drawing the line is. The interesting statistic the BBC have managed to dig out is this. They say just 20 stalkers a year were jailed for longer than 12 months for putting a victim in fear of violence, while others just spent days in jail or were sentenced to community orders or, as they describe it, inappropriate domestic violence courses. Now, the thing is, even if somebody commits a summary-only offence, so this is the lesser of the two offences, one that's only punishable by 6 months imprisonment, the law already has in place ways of massively escalating very quickly
very, very
how they're
quickly,
dealt with.
Particularly when we're talking about offences over 10 years.
Yeah. There is already, in law, space for application for action. There's various different types of orders that could cover it. Firstly, could be covered by antisocial behaviour orders. Well, those are punishable by imprisonment of, in fact, I can't remember what the maximum penalty is for breaching.
10 years, is it?
Certainly quite significant. I'd have to look it up what the maximum is. But there's one possibility. There's also restraining orders.
Which, probably the most important point there for anyone who doesn't know, is that if you are convicted of harassment...
Yeah.
In fact, actually, even if you're not convicted of it, if you're merely charged with it and we get to court, one possible solution there is a restraining order preventing that person from having any contact with the victim of the harassment. So you don't even need to be convicted for the Crown to apply for that.
Section 5A order,
And then if you then breach that, starting point is a custodial sentence and a fairly hefty one again.
So... Again, I mean, something of a theme on the show, I realise, but it's something of a theme in terms of the way the law is being discussed, I suppose. The answer is, the law is already there, if only you would use it properly.
Or indeed, if you just read it.
That would help, that'd be a start.
Before you start calling for new laws, perhaps have a read of what the old law is.
Well, I can't remember, was it on the show, did I say on the show last week that the introduction to Blackstone's criminal practice says that effectively... Whew, at least there's no more raft of laws coming through under the last government. Well, doesn't take long, does it? Here we go. Let's rewrite the law.
This is cross-parliamentary. You really think at the moment, with everything that's going on in the world, this is what we should be spending parliamentary time doing.
Instead,
rewriting a law so it says, well, the same as it said before, really.
Yeah.
Calling it something different, I don't know.
And again, you know, we have a Director of Public Prosecutions in Keir Starmer, somebody who is more than able to set out, well, crack the whip, I suppose, within the CPS. Police training and education on domestic violence has been very effective over the years. There's no reason why it wouldn't be over this. In fact, I find the police, this is actually something they're really rather swift at dealing with harassment cases.
Possibly too swift to some degree, because it does seem to be one thing that is fair is that this Act, the English Act, has been used time and again, really, for dealing with messy breakups and domestic situations, albeit possibly where there has been domestic violence. But I don't think that's what the Act was intended for in the first place. It actually was intended, realistically, to deal with stalking.
Well, it was partly in response to the 10-minute rule bill brought forward. Anyway, there you go. So if, we'll come back to contacting us in a moment. Right, so moving on. Court of Protection, controversial court that it is, has issued a judgment which we're going to delve into a little bit, but not in too much detail, because it seems that there's something a little bit odd about it. Kirsten?
Well, I think we're going to try and discuss possibly things to do with the Court of Protection generally. This is the... ruling of His Honour Mr. Justice Headley in regard to a lady by the name, in this case, of H. She's 29, she's autistic, and she has a low IQ level, so I think it's 64. And she, as I said, she's autistic as well. She has been highly sexualised throughout her life and is constantly finding herself, it appears, in situations where she is vulnerable to sexual advances and doesn't seem wholly to understand that she can say no to those, or possibly she does but doesn't really have the capacity to actually say no, even if she realises it's a possible option to her. And it does seem that she's been suffering possibly some quite nasty and degrading treatment. As a result, there is now a ruling... and I say thank you to The Telegraph for drawing this to my attention. There's a ruling from His Honour, Mr. Justice Headley. That she is now prevented from having sex because she doesn't have the capacity, and therefore he's made a ruling that she is not to have sex. The suggestion in The Telegraph, which bothers me somewhat, is that it suggests that anyone, therefore, who tried to have sexual intercourse with her could be charged with sexual assault or rape. Now, there are several issues with this. To be fair, His Honour Mr. Justice Headley does actually raise the problem in terms of the criminal law.
Yeah.
He does actually say in his judgment that he can't, in effect, give a blanket ruling that people having sex with her would be guilty of rape. He recognises the criminal justice system might have something to say about
that. Would make him a statutory authority, effectively.
Well, indeed, and also just in terms of the criminal justice system, obviously involves the mindset of the man involved.
Yeah,
so
quite.
He didn't realise that she...
So it wouldn't be the same as statutory rape, although I suspect any prosecution brought on the basis of this this young lady would be that there was an argument to say that there was a lack of volition on her part.
And that she couldn't give consent, yes. The bit that... Obviously, there's quite a lot of... It's controversial because this is somebody saying that, you know, telling a human being that they are not to have sex. And also, it covers the issue of her being able to consent to marriage. And he specifically goes into this in the judgment, in that he says it's the point of marriage. One of the necessary things for marriage is that...
Consummation.
Is consummation. And that... so he says at paragraph 33, having concluded that H lacks capacity to consent to sexual relations, let me turn to the issue of capacity to marry. H shows no present disposition to marry. Marriage, of course, raises more and complex issues than does consent to sexual relations. On the other hand, for so long as marriage requires sexual intercourse for its consummation, it must follow that the person who lacks capacity to consent to sexual relations must lack capacity to marry.
Ooh, I'm not so sure I follow his reasoning there. For this reason, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it the case that, you remember the distinction from law school between void and voidable marriages? Void is if it effectively fundamentally breaches one of the absolute requirements for marriage. Voidable means that the marriage can be made void or declared void if one or other of the trigger factors are met. Now, he says it must follow that she lacks consent to marry if she's unable to consummate a marriage. I don't think that's right.
That's not quite what he says. What he says is that if you lack the capacity to consent to sexual relations, then in effect you lack the capacity to consent to consummating the marriage. And if then you cannot enter into marriage knowing that you are not capable of consenting to consummation.
I think you can. I think you can. I don't think there's anything in the law that stops that.
You certainly would be able to enter into marriage without the capacity to the marriage, but that's not quite the same as consenting to it. So, in effect, what he's saying is you could never consent to a valid marriage.
I think
you
can.
And you think it would be valid. Yeah, I think that's a good point.
I think you can absolutely consent to it. I think you'd have absolutely no... no way of arguing if your husband, in her case, then came back before the end of 12 months or at the end of 12 months and
even
said...
Even after that, potentially.
And said, look, this has gone nowhere in the bedroom. Consequently, I want the marriage declaring void. There's very little response
I
to
suppose
that. But you would have the capacity to marry. You may not have the capacity to marry for the purposes of the Marriage Act. That's a different matter in terms of your...
Well, that's a separate issue. That's what
that's
what he's saying.
But he says the rationale is because you can't consent to sex...
Well, I suppose
sex,
the point is...
You can't consent to consummation. Consummation is necessary for the marriage. Therefore... And that's the way he expresses it in paragraph 33, and I think that's wrong.
Possibly what it is if you have a ruling that somebody is unable to consent, does not have the capacity to consent to sexual relations, then clearly the other party would know that before they entered into the marriage, and perhaps that makes it void. It's all very interesting law, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you what.
Well, if you know somebody comes into a marriage knowing that they cannot really consent to what the marriage is about, then actually, yes, I think you can, because you're taking advantage of somebody.
Yeah, but that's voidable. It is capable of being declared void. It is not. It doesn't prevent you from getting married.
No, I think he's in effect saying one follows from the other in terms of the capacity. If you can't... anyway.
With the greatest respect to the Honourable Mr. Justice Headley, I disagree. But
the other problem I have with this...
In fairness, that's because I haven't actually looked at the subject of marriage and the law since I was a law student.
No, perhaps we should do that.
Maybe it's changed. Who knows?
I know there's a lecture at Manchester Metropolitan University coming up very soon about marriage and whether it's whether there's a point to it in the current... day and age.
I must have missed the email for that one.
The other problem I have with this ruling, and I'm wondering if any of our listeners can help me with this, because it's not an area that I've ever really turned my mind to before in terms of the Court of Protection itself, because there's an exclusion under Section 27 of the Mental Capacity Act, which is the act under which this ruling that of law of Mr. Justice Headley falls.
Specifically, it's the act that gives the court of protection the majority of its powers.
Gives it everything, really, yeah. Yes. Section 27 is cover... Well, the sections around Section 27 cover exclusions to the powers of the court of protection. And Section 27 says family relationships, etc. Nothing in this Act permits a decision on any of the following matters to be made on behalf of a person. A. Consenting to marriage or civil partnership. And B. Consenting to have sexual relations. Mm. Now, we've gone round this off-air as to what that could possibly mean, and we do have a possible construction as
to... I should say neither of us are court of protection practitioners, so...
I haven't had a great deal to do with... It pops up every so often. But this is... To me, when I first read that, it read to me as though the court cannot, in effect, interfere with matters of consent of sexual relations.
But this case isn't the only one where the court has purported so to do.
Which makes me think that must be read wrongly. So I think what we decided was we'd cover this, hopefully, in a bit more depth on a further show. But it's an interesting case. It raises all sorts of moral and legal arguments in terms of this woman who has clearly had a dreadful time of it, really, it would appear. Mm. Although how much she realises she's had a dreadful time of it, I don't know, because she is quite clearly, up until this ruling, consenting to all sorts of sexual relations and activities. She didn't have the capacity for.
I should just say this, that judgment, although it's a final judgment as I understand it, Mr. Justice Headley did say that there was, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, but there was a capacity for the woman's understanding of the health and presumably safety implications of consenting to sexual intercourse to develop and improve over time. And as a result, it could be reviewed in the future. So,
The local authority have already been trying to educate H about sexual protection and sexual health issues, and they will continue. So they're hopeful that eventually something will go in, although she has difficulties retaining information.
And there have been cases in the past where they've decided that actually somebody can't have that explanation made to them for various reasons. Right, well, there it is. So if you know an awful lot about that subject and you want to contact us, you can do so via a number of different means. Kirsten, how do they do it?
You can mail us at northpod.co.uk. Probably the easiest way, if you want to actually get a response quickly and give us some details for how we can talk to you for longer, is via Twitter. And we are at NorthPodLaw.
Follow us. Come follow us. It's fun. We occasionally retweet things that other people have said.
And if you want a really direct approach,
yep.
Then you can telephone us on...
Oh, God, are you going to do it this week? Come on, last one of the series, you do it.
0161408 5037.
Another nod to Helen and Ollie answering this. And they did. I tweeted at them this week, you know, and they didn't reply. But I should be listening on Thursday when I download this week's show from them and seeing if they mention us. They won't, you know.
No, too big now.
Helen and Ollie, answer us this. In the judgment of that case, has the judge acted ultra vires vis-a-vis the Mental Capacity Act 2005? Yeah, come on, answer that one, Ollie man. or not. If you don't know what I'm talking about, and as I say, if you don't mind a bit of blue language, you probably should download their show. It entertains me greatly. And you've got 6 weeks now of us not being on the air. So
what are you going to do?
Listen to Helen and Ollie. All right, so people have contacted us on Twitter. We are grateful to Stephanie Richardson. She describes Sunday as North Pod Law Listening Day. Dogs plus walk plus podcast equals hashtag karma. Hmm. 36 Bedford Row. What are they talking to us about? Oh, no, yes, we retweeted this. If you are appealing, I think you may be out of time now, nearly. If you're appealing the CPS Advocate Panel result that you received, if you're counsel, or if you're solicitor prosecutors, presumably, then you ought to go and read the CPS website guidance on that. It was retweeted last week on the show. If in doubt, just go and have a look at the CPS website and look under the section Advocate Panel, and you'll see what to do and read the guidance there. It's quite interesting. Our thanks to Mark Pritchard, who says we answered his question. I'm glad he thinks that. We sort of tried, didn't we? Mark Pritchard also wonders whether... What's this? Does Ben's use of the word bygones a lot in this week's show mean he's an Ally McBeal fan? Well, as I said to him, it's because, and we will actually, oddly enough, come back to this at some point in the future, I've just been re-watching the entire of Ally McBeal on DVD. having just finished the entire Boston Legal on DVD, and I'm sort of halfway through Harry's Law. All of those shows have something in common. They're all written by the same guy, who I'm desperately, desperately keen to get on the show, if you're listening. We may come back to Law on television at some point in... we may try next series, let's see. But yes, the answer is that's quite right. I'm now putting the finger to my side of the, to the side of my nose. There you go. Moving on. Dan Bunting has also contacted us, presumably with exasperation about the Matt Jonathan race last week, about the CPS moving the goalposts in terms of charging decisions or changing charges during the course of proceedings. Thanks, Dan, for the link you sent us. Yes, it does indeed suggest there are other problems. Go back and look at our Twitter feed for that, but it's... case beginning with B, I've forgotten the name of now, dating back to 2008, I think, where it's a similar thing discussed. Yes, I quite agree. Total mess. So there we go. Right, so moving on, just a couple of things very quickly before we let you go. You've stayed your hour, that's it, bugger off. So, the Law Services Consumer Panel have issued a report on comparison websites. These are a sort of new thing, well, it's newish, I suppose, springing up all over the shop. If you Google solicitors in a certain town these days, you're quite likely to get, and I think this is partly what the Consumer Panel found, pages and pages of, quite frankly, nonsensical results from various people who just put the name and address of a solicitor's firm. Half of them are out of date, I have to say, from my observation. But these things are generated as a result of people spending money on advertising. If you're a solicitor in practice, you will fairly routinely, unless your secretary is very, very good at filtering them out, get people phoning from all sorts of these sort of comparison websites. You can sign up to all sorts of comparisons. The problem is, as the report found, I mean, it's actually quite a complicated report in the sense there's an awful lot of observations made by it. But in short, they're not very helpful. They don't tend to, although there are some exceptions, they don't tend to separate the categories of work undertaken. Sometimes, in fact, the categories indicated, if they do indicate them, are misleading. And the suggestion is there ought to be a legal services board accreditation scheme for the way in which these things are advertised. So the idea is that effectively, it's too tedious for words. The idea, I'm boring myself with this story.
I've switched off already, I'm afraid, listeners.
Yeah, so voluntary standards, first of all. Well, that could work. It's not going to, is it? A legal services board accreditation scheme so that these organisations have to all be regulated effectively by the, presumably, the Law Society, I imagine, or somebody similar, or legal services board. That probably won't work either. Interestingly enough, article from the Legal Futures blog, which you can find a link to in the show notes, if not, just www.legalfutures.co.uk. It's the article titled Taming the Wild West of Legal Comparison Websites. The author of that report says, well, it seems to me far more straightforward to beef up professional conduct rules so as to put the onus on law firms to ensure that those sites they sign up to meet certain standards in a similar way to how the referral rules work, which, of course, they should already be doing. Do you know what? Kind of agree. That's probably exactly what should be doing. He recounts an interesting story, and I won't go through the article, but actually read on to the sort of the last few paragraphs where he talks about the managing partner of Quality Solicitors. In short, he says he went to a Quality Solicitors sales training session during which his firm was called up with an inquiry in front of all of the other delegates. That's quite embarrassing, isn't it? His confidence that it would be dealt with well soon crumbled. So, in other words, yeah, really, the point is solicitors are spending a lot of money on sites that aren't doing anything for them, and then their first point of contact is all too frequently somebody who reads out a price list. He gives the example of wills, reads out a price list and then puts the phone down. What they're saying is actually, no, what they should be doing is giving them contact to a lawyer and letting the lawyer get to know the potential client, letting them discuss their needs, then talk to them about the pricing as well, keep it nice and open and clear, but don't act like, well, the irony is, I read that as don't act like a call centre, and actually that article goes on to suggest effectively that there ought to be a call centre route. In fact, quality solicitors are taking that route. That's where I part ways with the author of that article. I think call centre's a ridiculous idea.
I think it rather depends, actually, because call centres vary. Somebody who used to work in a call centre environment, they vary tremendously. If you phone up as a warm caller, you should be treated well and ask what it is that you're after, and then you should be matched to what it is that you want. It's actually just called good sales technique.
And that's the point of all of this, which is that, oh dear, lawyers are absolutely crap at selling themselves and their services. Well, there it is. I was about to make an unfortunate segue into our final story about selling yourself, but that's to completely misunderstand and entirely get wrong the distinction between lap dancing clubs and sexual encounter organisations or establishments.
I'll leave that to your greater experience of these things, Ben.
Well, you mean as a licensing practitioner? Yes, quite right, Kirsten. All right, this is it's a discursive piece by John Kelly in the BBC News magazine section from the 8th of February. This is a piece titled "The Rise and Fall of Lap Dancing." In short, I suppose his headline is this: strip clubs across England and Wales face closure thanks to changes in licensing rules reversing a previous boom. How did the explosion in lap dancing change the country? I'm not that interested in the bit about how it changed the country. What I am perhaps interested in, from the point of view of this show anyway, is this. The Licensing Act 2003 created effectively one category of licensed organisations, or licensed establishments rather. And people would be granted licences as long as they complied with what are called the licensing objectives. So basically, if they would fail under one of the heads of crime, nuisance, or endangerment of the public, effectively. And as long as they didn't, then they were free, whether they were a lap dancing club or whether they were a small cafe bar that sold food or drink after certain times, or whether they sold alcohol, whatever, then they were fine. 2010 brought around a slight distinction in that, which was the classification of, or separate classification of, sex establishments or sexual encounter establishments. That opens the scope then in 2010 for residents of areas in which these applications are made to oppose venues for being inappropriate to the area. Guess what happened then?
Not in my backyard.
Well, quite. Rightly or wrongly, I mean, I'm sure there are some cases where it was perfectly right and some cases where it was perhaps a little bit silly, depending on your view of these things as a general principle. April 2012, as a result of all that, these premises were only allowed to continue operating if their licensees made an application for them to continue. Effectively, they had to go back under the licensing objectives and prove it again. That presumably must have cut the number fairly significantly. So the sort of suggestion is now that all of these organisations, all of these businesses rather, that attempted to took advantage of the licensing laws, are now having the door shut on them again as a result of these, I suppose we'd call them, nil policies that are arriving
all
over the country.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, is that you can meet all the criteria, but if there's a blanket ban, then there's going to be some judicial review going on,
well,
here,
it's
possibly.
Exactly. It's going too far one direction, perhaps, and then too far the other direction. I mean, the BBC say council licensing committees were often powerless to reject applications and the number of clubs surged. Well, actually, do you know what? They were never powerless to reject applications that had good foundation. They couldn't reject out of hand applications because they simply didn't approve of lap dancing clubs, because Parliament had said that that was a licensable activity.
But you can say there are too many in the area, and therefore it isn't.
Absolutely.
It is affecting the spirit of the area.
Taxis coming and going late at night,
yep.
Frequent one. No suitable facilities for parking. Frequent one. The performers
the
at
ones,
the time of time of closing had to wait around and get taxis, and there was nowhere suitably lit for them to wait. All sorts of things are thrown up, and do you know what? Really doesn't take a local authority that much effort if they want to find against one of these applications to do so. Nevertheless, the suggestion is now that there's nothing wrong with absolute nil tolerance policies. There are various places in the country. Go and read the article if you want to read more about it. But there are various places around the country where these nil policies have been approached. I think careful local authorities,
I
think you may be fettering your discretion, and consequently may find yourselves guilty find yourselves at the receiving end of judicial review proceedings.
Indeed,
for
so.
That very reason. So that's pretty much it. No time to talk about Graham Norton ending to the show. So there's so little time to talk about any of these other things.
Well, I think we've covered everything we wanted to.
I think we probably have. Thank you, as always, for listening to our little show. We do so enjoy ourselves, don't
perhaps
we?
I should point out that on the subject of judicial review, our regular correspondent, Mr. Holt, is here tonight. Did anybody even notice he wasn't here?
Very quiet,
really?
He's
busy on a panic judicial review and emergency application, so that's where he is.
He is indeed. But you're with us, and that's all that counts.
Indeed.
So join us again in 6 weeks' time. You know the date of that is?
I haven't got a clue.
No, me either.
I'll put it on the show notes. Please let us know if there's anything you particularly want us to cover. We like it best when we are serving your needs.
Absolutely. As the lap dancing clubs, apparently. I don't know. Let us know if you want to cover anything, any commentary, anything else. We'll still be monitoring Twitter and our voicemail throughout the time we're off air. And hopefully you'll come back and join us soon.